For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show normally recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today I'm recording in the cupboard under the stairs.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and I'm recording in my bedroom. But coming up on today's show,
I'll be talking to narrator Leighton Pugh and finding out how Samuel Pepys viewed the Great Plague of 1665.
I'll be reading some books in the RNIB Talking Books Library on mindfulness and happiness, books to self-isolate with.
Actress Juliet Stevenson will reveal just how important being an RNIB narrator is to her.
And we'll hear from publisher Sarah Band and author Graham McRae Burnett in episode 1 of their Cabin Fever Fables.
That's all coming up in today's show. Ah, a bit of cabin fever. We can all relate to that at the moment.
It's actually a really nice podcast. I'll tell you how we can listen to more episodes later on, but episode 1 with Graham McRae Burnett self-isolating with some wine is coming up later on. But first, in today's show, Red, you met Leighton Pugh.
Yeah, and I recorded the intro just before I learned how to muffle my microphone properly.
So here's an echoey Red and Leighton Pugh.
The day before the current coronavirus restrictions came into force, I was at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden, making myself a cup of tea in the kitchen, when I heard a familiar voice. It belonged to Samuel Pepys, the 100-year-old man who climbed out of the window and disappeared, and countless other books that I've thoroughly enjoyed. It was narrator Leighton Pugh. So I seized my opportunity and invited him into the RNIB Connect Radio studio.
Leighton, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Having just grabbed you out of the kitchen, can you tell me what you're recording at the moment for us?
Okay, so we're up to our necks in Nietzsche at the moment. We're doing Beyond Good and Evil for Penguin Classics. This is one of the important titles of the 20th century for them. So, yeah, I'm reading Nietzsche.
That's a pretty heavy read. Does it narrate well, or is it hard work?
You have to think about each sentence. So it doesn't leap off the page, but if you work out where the sentence begins and where it ends, and sometimes that's an entire page, and break it up into clauses and realize what it's doing grammatically, then it makes sense. Even if sometimes I don't actually conceptually always get it, I can make it grammatically work, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You have to convince us that you understand it conceptually, don't you? Otherwise, we don't stand a chance as the listener.
That's true. I think I do, yes, yeah. I have to. And I try to understand it in that first way. But sometimes, you know, you can't get everything. So it's about making the grammar work. And if you hit the right words in a sentence, I think people understand it.
Now, some narrators wing it, mm-hmm. but are you one of those who will read the text once or twice beforehand and mark it up?
Yes, I've never gone in for a cold read, not once really. Occasionally you might make more progress than you'd wanted to and have to wing it a bit more than you'd like to. But no, I always read it, even if it's a skim read, and definitely put the words in the margin in phonetics that are tricky.
You're no stranger to difficult characters. I noticed that you've narrated a definitive biography of Napoleon and also Sympathy for the Devil, the Paul Trinker book charting the early years of the Rolling Stones.
Yes, yes. I did enjoy the Rolling Stones biography because I don't get that many biographies and I like them. I like them as a genre myself. So I do remember that. I can see myself recording that in Peterborough a few years back now. Napoleon too, I've sort of developed a non-fiction based niche really, which as well as fiction on, so what is it, about 75% non-fiction. And I enjoy that for learning mainly, although it can be a challenge.
Well, they're both very weighty tomes. I think that each of them's over 25 hours. Mm-hmm. But of course, you are the man who bought us the Diaries of Samuel Pepys, which I think are well over 100 hours, all three volumes, aren't they?
They are. I think they come in at about 120 hours in total.
Goodness me. How long did that take?
They were recorded over 40 days here in Camden with a month between them. I was doing something else. I was doing some teaching job. And I think it actually worked out well that I had that time off, came back to it after a month, did 20 days and then another 20 days, yes.
Well, that was one of the first books that I remember listening to that you had narrated, because I'd always been rather wary of approaching Pepys. Mm-hmm. It's dense in places. It can be very fun as yes. well, but it's a hard read. Did you find it so?
I did, just in a purely technical way. The sentences go on and on. Sometimes they're not that punchy, so you have to keep the flow going through them, because he's writing almost at a flow, trying to get the words down, I think. And sometimes that's breathlessly exciting. Sometimes it's what's happening now. I enjoyed the anorak side of Pepys, the minutiae, the testing of different lengths of rope in the naval yard, the stuff that's taken out of the highlights version a lot of people know. So it was the first time it had ever been done completely unabridged. I enjoyed that, and I had the same producer, Ross, here at the RNIB for the whole time, and we became really interested in him and followed his life, and it ended with him telling us every year how much money he was worth. And we just loved the fact that he didn't have a filter and told us in these diaries everything he was feeling, his insecurities, really personal things about him and his wife and his lusts, his greed. There's no filter to him, and that was enjoyable.
And he, of course, lived through a time of fast spreading disease in London in 1665, and we're sitting here as London is being closed down around our ears. Mm-hmm. Did you take any lessons from that that you're going to be incorporating over the next few weeks?
Oh dear. Well, social distancing, I don't know how easy that was when you were going for your breakfast of beer and wine and hunks of meat that he had. I don't know. I mean, they didn't have the hand sanitizer, did they?
No,
we've
they
got
didn't.
On the table.
And they didn't close the ale houses.
And they didn't close them, no. What do we get from that? I suppose that life goes on despite a massive tragedy. What I'm thinking of now is the Great Fire, how London built itself up from that. There was a historian on the radio yesterday saying that he can see historically AC and BC after Corona and before Corona. So maybe it is something like the Great Fire for London.
And I think a lot of talking and audiobook fans are probably preparing themselves for those epic reads that we've been promising ourselves for so long. I'll certainly be going back to Pepys, so you'll be keeping me company anyway during the long weeks to come.
I'm so impressed that you got from the start to the finish. That's a marathon for the listener.
Off the back of that, you of course were offered the job of narrating the James Marwood books by Andrew Taylor, which are detective novels mm-hmm. set contemporaneously to Samuel Pepys.
They are, and it came directly from that, from Andrew Taylor enjoying the audiobooks. And it was an absolute delight to read the first one and to realise that he hadn't just listened to those books but had immersed himself in that world, a little like Hilary Mantel does. It was the real world, and he was making references that I could pick up from having read the diaries, calling the roof the leads and things like that. Just took me straight back to Pepys.
Yes, I mean, anybody who's a fan of, as you say, Hilary Mantel or the C.J. Sansom mm-hmm. books will absolutely love those Andrew Taylor books.
I think they're fabulous. They just leap from the page, and his dialogue and description is amazing.
One of the best listens that I've had over the last few years is the wonderful The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared by Jonas Jonasson. That must have been an absolute dream to read.
That was fantastic. I had a phase of getting some really, really good fiction sent to Peterborough, where I was recording at that time. And that was just an absolute treat. I had to make some decisions. That book actually caused me to start wondering about whether you could do transposition when you're doing a book written in a foreign language originally. Some people seem to like it and some people not so much, because I took some of the characters, made them British equivalent accents and characterizations. As I say, some people like that, some people don't. It's a bit like doing accents in non-fiction. People have very strong views on it. But that was the first one where I remember bringing in some Birmingham accents or London accents to try to bring a bit of colour to it, even though it's all set in Sweden. That was fantastic. It was just about the indomitable spirit of human beings, which we need now, don't we, with the coronavirus around our ears.
Absolutely. He's definitely a character. It's certainly one that I think I'll be rereading over the next few weeks.
Chapter 1. Monday, the 2nd of May, 2005. You might think he could have made up his mind earlier and been man enough to tell the others of his decision. But Allan Colson had never been given to pondering things too long. So the idea had barely taken hold in the old man's head before he opened the window of his room on the ground floor of the old people's home in the town of Malmköping and stepped out into the flower bed. This manoeuvre required a bit of effort, since Alam was 100 years old, on this very day, in fact. There was less than an hour to go before his birthday party would begin in the lounge of the old people's home. The mayor would be there, and the local paper, and all the other old people, and the entire staff, led by bad-tempered Director Alice. It was only the birthday boy himself who didn't intend to turn up.
My guest, Leighton Pugh, narrating The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared by Jonas Jonasson, which is TB20097.
Does comedy just roll off the tongue when you're narrating?
Yes, quality fiction, I think, is probably my dream job, yes. Getting those, they're rarer. I think that's why I like nonfiction. I think getting an absolute standout piece of literary fiction is the real gift. That's what you want. And people like Andrew Taylor provide that. But yes, I'd kill to do something like Hilary Mantel as well. Who wouldn't, though? I think every narrator would like to do that.
Is there a book from the back catalogues that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to get your hands on?
William Boyd, I did one of his. I think he really works well in audio, and I really like him as an author. So yes, I would love to do any William Boyd novel.
And are you big fan of audiobooks yourself, or will you pick up the paperback?
No, I become a huge fan of audiobooks. I always listen on the way to work with my headphones on. It's escapism, I think, that because, funnily enough, I prepare with the written word, I want someone to read a story to me on the way home. I want to rest my eyes.
I'm always struck by the atmosphere in the green room. There's no competition, there's no one-upmanship amongst the narrators. You clearly all enjoy each other's work.
That's right. I have a lot of respect for my colleagues, and particularly people who do completely different types of work. I often like to listen, for example, to American and to Irish books to have another voice in my ear. I just enjoy going into different worlds, going away from the world I know and hearing other voices.
Well, yes, when there's travel bans at the moment, what better way to step out through the pages of a book? Mm-hmm. Well, I better let you get back to Nietzsche. But Leighton Pugh, thank you so much for giving up your lunch break, and good luck over the next few weeks.
Thank you so much, Redner. It's been a pleasure, and I just hope to be back here for the rest of my life. It's an amazing place.
Thanks again to Leighton Pugh. For a full list of the wide range of terrific books that he's narrated, visit the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Well, that sounded like London calling from the bunker, didn't it? Happily, I've since learned how to pull the duvet over my head and muffle the recording.
We're all learning on the fly how to do this from home. They'll sound better. Each week it'll sound better and better.
Well, and you'll be glad to know that Leighton did finish recording that talking book, and it's now going into the RNIB library.
Fantastic. And talking of RNIB library, here's something I recorded earlier about some books to self-isolate with.
In this time of uncertainty, I thought I'd take a quick virtual wander through the shelves of the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some books that may help. First up, The Ultimate Happiness Prescription by Deepak Chopra.
The purpose of life is the expansion of happiness. Happiness is the goal of every other goal. Most people are under the impression that happiness comes from becoming successful, accumulating wealth, being healthy and having good relationships. There is certainly enormous social pressure to believe that these accomplishments are the same as achieving happiness. However, this is a mistake.
With words like depression and recession in the air, the author underlines the importance of keeping an eye on the positive aspects of life and finding ways to experience joy no matter what is happening. This book explains how to maintain an optimistic outlook and experience the benefits of having a happy heart and soul, no matter what the circumstances. It's read for you by the brilliant Bob Rollett.
Success, wealth, good health and nurturing relationships are byproducts of happiness, not the cause. When you are happy, you are more likely to make choices that lead to all these things. The reverse isn't true. Everyone has observed people who are deeply unhappy, even after they have attained incredible wealth and success. Good health can be taken for granted and abused. And even the happiest family can find its happiness ruined by a sudden crisis. Unhappy people are not successful, and no amount of money and achievement will change the equation. So, let's shift our gaze beyond external indications to inner happiness, which we all want to attain, and yet which remains elusive.
Bob Rollett, reading from The Ultimate Happiness Prescription by Deepak Chopra. It's a short book. It only lasts for 3 hours and 3 minutes. Also in the library is 59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman. Think a little, change a lot.
Discover why even thinking about going to the gym can help keep you in shape. Learn how pot plants can make you more creative. Find out why putting a pencil between your teeth instantly makes you feel happier.
In 59 Seconds, psychologist Professor Richard Wiseman presents a fresh approach to change that helps people achieve their aims and ambitions in minutes, not months. From mood to memory, persuasion to procrastination, and resilience to relationships, Wiseman outlines the research supporting this new science of rapid change and describes how these quick and quirky techniques can be incorporated into everyday life.
People behave in highly predictable ways when they experience certain emotions and thoughts. When they are sad, they cry. When they are happy, they smile. When they agree, they nod their heads. So far, no surprises. But according to an area of research known as proprioceptive psychology, the same process also works in reverse. Get people to behave in a certain way, and you cause them to feel certain emotions and have certain thoughts. The idea was initially controversial, but was fortunately supported by a series of compelling experiments. In one, now classic, study, two groups of people were asked to add up a list of numbers. During the task, one group were asked to furrow their brows, or, as the researchers put it, contract their corrugator muscle, while the others were requested to adopt a slight grin, extend their zygomaticus muscle. This simple act of facial contortion had a surprising effect on participants' ratings of how hard they found the number-adding task, with the frowning participants convinced that they had expended far more effort than the grinning group. In a different study, participants were asked to concentrate on various products moving across a large computer screen, and then indicate whether the items appealed to them. Some of the items moved vertically, causing the participants to nod their heads while watching, while others moved horizontally, resulting in a side-to-side head movement. Participants preferred vertically moving products without being aware that their yes and no head movements had played a key role in their decisions. Exactly the same idea applies to happiness. People smile when they are happy, but also feel happier because they are smiling. The effect even works whether people are aware of the smile or not. In the 1980s, Fritz Strack and his colleagues asked two groups of people to judge how funny they found Gary Larson's Far Side cartoons and rate how happy they felt under one of two rather bizarre circumstances. One group were asked to hold a pencil between their teeth, but to ensure that it did not touch their lips. The other group supported the end of the pencil with their lips, but not their teeth. Without realizing it, those in the teeth-only condition had forced the lower part of their faces into a smile, while those in the lips-only condition had made themselves frown. The results revealed that the participants tended to experience the emotion associated with their expressions. Those who had their faces forced into a smile felt happier, and found the Far Side cartoons much funnier than those who were forced to frown. Other work has demonstrated that this increase in happiness does not drain away the moment people cease smiling. It lingers on, affecting many aspects of their behaviour, including interacting with others in a more positive way and being more likely to remember happy life events. The message from this type of work is simple. If you want to cheer yourself up, behave like a happy person.
Robin Houston, narrating 59 Seconds, Think a Little, Change a Lot by Professor Richard Wiseman, which lasts for 8 hours and 38 minutes. And finally, if you're stuck at home at the moment, why not learn about the history of that domicile with At Home, A Short History of Private Life by Bill Bryson.
I don't know how many hours of my school years were spent studying the Missouri Compromise or the War of the Roses, but it was vastly more than I was ever encouraged or allowed to give to the history of eating, sleeping, having sex, or endeavouring to be amused.
Bill Bryson considers what most of history really consists of, centuries upon centuries of people quietly going about their daily business. He started a journey through his own house, an old rectory in Norfolk, wandering from room to room, considering how the ordinary things in life came to be. Along the way, he allowed himself digressions on the history of everything from architecture to epidemics, from food preservation to the discovery of electricity, and from crinolines to toilets.
So I thought it might be interesting, for the length of a book, to consider the ordinary things in life, to notice them for once, and treat them as if they were important too. Looking around my house, I was startled and a little appalled to realize how little I knew about the domestic world around me. Sitting at the kitchen table one afternoon, playing idly with the salt and pepper shakers, it occurred to me that I had absolutely no idea why, out of all the spices in the world, we have such an abiding attachment to those too. Why not pepper and cardamom, say, or salt and cinnamon? And why do forks have four tines and not three or five? There must be reasons for these things. Dressing, I wondered why all my suit jackets have a row of pointless buttons on every sleeve. I heard a reference on the radio to someone paying for room and board, and realized that when people talk about room and board, I have no idea what the board is that they are talking about. Suddenly, the house seemed a place of mystery to me. So I formed the idea to make a journey around it, to wander from room to room and consider how each is featured in the evolution of private life. The bathroom would be a history of hygiene, the kitchen of cooking, the bedroom of sex and death and sleeping, and so on. I would write a history of the world without leaving home.
At Home, A Short History of Private Life is written and read by Bill Bryson, and it lasts for 16 hours, 33 minutes. The RNIB Library is free to join for anyone with a print disability, and it can all be done online. Just head to Reading Services, that's all one word, readingservices.rnib.org.uk. Or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Robert. Plenty to keep me happy there.
You're very welcome. Now, let's go back in time. Last week, we were talking about Belgravia.
Indeed, which has audio description and which I've thoroughly been enjoying watching my wife.
The Book of Belgravia came out in 2016, released on an app and in audio format before the print book came out.
And the audio of that book was read by Juliet Stevenson, who I was lucky enough to meet last year. Juliet Stevenson is a star of stage, screen and audio. Her roll call of stage plays and audiobooks includes some of the best-known works in English literature. Not that she's let it go to her head. Despite all these calls on her time, particularly to record commercial audiobooks, she's still a regular at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. And being truly, madly and deeply a fan, I just had to ask her into the studio for a chat. Juliet Stevenson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Can you tell me what you're recording for us at the moment?
Yes, I'm recording a novel by Antonia Byatt, otherwise known as A.S. Byatt, called The Children's Book, which I mistakenly thought was going to be a children's book. And I thought, why is it going to take 9.5 days in a studio? No child would read a book that long. But it turns out that's just the title. It's an adult novel written a few years ago, something like 2009, I think. Huge, rambling piece set at the end of the 19th century. Amazing story. But we're only on day two, so, you know, we've got a long way to go.
How much stamina, in comparison to your stage work, does it take to take on a large novel like that?
Well, I really love recording large novels. I just love the whole thing of going into a booth at 9:30 or 10 in the morning and staying there all the working day with this work of literature. It's kind of heaven for me. If the book's good, if it's not a good book, then it's a slightly different story. But most of what I'm really lucky to be asked to do are great books. So it's delicious for me to sit and do that. I mean, yeah, there's a certain point mid-afternoon where your tongue starts to feel like it's 6 foot wide and you can get a bit squinty. But I really do love it. And I love the immersion. I think what I love in all forms of work is just the immersion right down into it. And with a audiobook, that's what you're doing. You're sinking down into this book. You have to play all the characters. You get right inside the story, the novel, the observations, the thinking, the world of the fiction. And I kind of love that about it. And also, I'm not that well read. I didn't go to university and so on. So I'm very grateful to the audiobook world for allowing me, giving me the chance and paying me to read some of the world's great literature.
And do you do huge amounts of preparation, marking up in different coloured pens the different characters?
I don't mark up, partly because I read off a screen these days and I can't be bothered to work those apps which you write on your screen. But yeah, I read ahead. I don't always read the whole novel before I start. I mean, ideally I would, but with huge novels, I don't always have time. So I would always read ahead of where I'm going to record. What I do is I make notes about each character. So I'll write down notes on every single person who speaks, what the author says about them, age, class, where they come from, think about what accent they might have, if any, to do with class and region, the age, obviously, so where you pitch it, and then what kind of rhythm. I'm very preoccupied by rhythms, and everybody has their own. Some people speak very fast, they think fast but speak slowly, or they think slowly and speak fast, or they speak slowly but are very powerful, or, you know, there's loads of things with rhythm that you can do. So those are the sorts of questions I will think about and make notes on. And if, as is the case with this A.S. Byatt book, you've got loads of different characters having conversations between six, seven, eight people in one scene, then I might cast it in my head. Because you can't really jump constantly to your notes and be reading notes every time somebody speaks. So if you cast it, so it might be, I think this character sounds like Theresa May, or sounds like David Attenborough, or sounds like the postman who comes round our house. Whoever it is, if you have somebody in your head who you think really sounds like this character, then it's a quick, easy way to jump from one to the other.
That must be where your experience of working in the theatre and working in film must come in invaluable, because you can be a director. You have worked with some amazing directors in your time and you can emulate them.
Yes, it's true. You are self-directing a lot of the time. I mean, you know, you've got a producer or a very skilled engineer the other side of the glass who's also got views on this, but I would expect for myself to make most of the decisions, and then they'll let you know if they don't like it. Or the other big consideration, perhaps the most important one for me, is what is the tone of this particular writer's voice? I don't like audiobooks where the reader is getting in the way. I love listening to them, and my kids, all the family, does do that, and we love it. But I'm always happiest when the reader is not too much getting in the way of the author. So in my view, your job is also to establish what kind of tone is this person writing in. Nick Hornby, Jane Austen, you know, Kazuo Ichiguro, or I don't know, Ali Smith. I mean, they've all got very, very different tones, and it's partly your job to find out how does this writer sound, and then serve her or him and keep yourself a bit out of the way.
You mentioned Jane Austen, and obviously the A.S. Byatt book is another period piece. Do you enjoy historical fiction or period pieces more than any other type of fiction, or do you just get given more of those books than anything else nowadays?
I don't necessarily enjoy them more. I mean, I love reading contemporary fiction, and I'm always delighted to have a brand new book that's hot off the press, because a lot of what I love to do in the theatre and in screen is to speak to now. I mean, that's really what I want to do, is tell stories about how we are now, where are we in our world, our current world, and how do I speak to that, and how do we collectively speak to it. So that's my sort of great passion, I suppose. So I'm very happy to do new books, but it just so happens I have been asked to do a lot of classics. So yeah, I've done all of Jane Austen, twice over at least, for different publishers. I've done a lot of George Eliot, which was fantastic. I've done a lot of Brontes, and quite often you get to sort of the less known works. I've done almost all of Virginia Woolf. Yes, there's been a lot of that. But I've also done quite a lot of contemporary stuff.
Yes, you did a fantastic Barbara Vine, The Brimstone Wedding, a few years ago, which was a terrific book.
Yeah.
And some Rose Tremaine as well, I see, as
well.
Oh,
that was an amazing, called Trespass. Amazing book. I loved doing that. I was completely riveted. That's one I hadn't finished reading when I started, so it partly kept me on my toes as I was reading. Yeah, I loved her.
And you had us all on the edge of our seats a couple of years ago as you were reading each new chapter of Julian Fellowes's Belgravia on a weekly basis.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Yes, that was fun. That was a fun one, because that was obviously set in a period of history. And that's a great challenge, because I don't think people did sound exactly like us. I mean, you don't want to put on silly voices. You don't want to distance the listener from the book. At the same time, I think it's always important to have a sense of how people might have spoken at different periods of history, and not to contemporize everything. So yeah, that was really good fun, that one.
Now, that's the book that you read all by yourself. I noticed that some of the books in the RNIB library you've read with a cast of two or three other narrators. That seems to be becoming a little bit more common. Is that something that you enjoy doing, or would you prefer to read the entire book yourself?
I'm very happy to do it. It's a bit odd, because you don't meet the other reader normally, and they either have already recorded and you're coming in after, or the other way around. And so there's no collective decision about how you're going to read it and what the tone of that author is, as I just talked about. I probably would rather read the whole thing myself, because I'm, you know, a bit of a junkie for this and a bit of a workaholic. So I'm so happy to immerse in the whole book. But there are times when a book really requires a male voice and a female voice, or different kinds of voice, or whatever. So it's an interesting development. And I think it may be lovely for the reader to have more than one, just me droning on hour after hour, but to have a sense of readers coming and going. But yeah, it's not as satisfying in the end, because you haven't read the whole thing.
And of course, the other ensemble cast talking books that we have are some of the radio plays that you've recorded. I'm thinking particularly of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd that you recorded for our 80th anniversary.
Ah, yeah. Now, those are really good fun. Yeah, those are great. But that's a really different experience. That's more like, well, it's just, yeah, it's a radio play. It's a very different experience. But they're really good fun. And I also did not long ago a version of Mary Poppins, a dramatised version of the original book, which is much darker and stranger than the Mary Poppins film, the original film. So, yeah, they can be great fun, but they're not quite as immersive as reading an entire book.
And I can't let you go without mentioning The Very Hungry Caterpillar. That sounds like it was terrific fun to record, and you did that with the poet Roger McGough.
Yes, I did. Well, my kids had all read that endlessly. You know, we've got copies at home which are sort of chewed and spattered with, you know, orange juice and God knows what, the record of their childhoods, and very moth-eaten book, much loved. So, yeah, it was lovely to be asked to do that. I do love reading children's literature. I read to both my kids a lot. And my son I read to until he was about 14, 15, actually. So that takes us through a lot of literature, and yeah, it's a particular pleasure reading for children.
So if I could offer you any book in the library to record, what would be the book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to get hold of?
Oh, what a great question. Well, I desperately wanted to read the Harry Potter books, because I'd read four or five of them to my daughter at the time, and I got completely immersed and I had voices for all those characters. I was particularly proud of my Hagrid and my Dobby the elf. And so I was absolutely furious with Stephen Fry when he was chosen to record them. So if they ever wanted to re-record them with a female voice, because it is a female author, then I would like to put myself forward, please, to be thought about. I would adore to do those books.
Well, let's hope that J.K. Rowling is listening to this programme, and I look forward to seeing plenty more of you if you do come back and record those 7 whopping great books. Juliet Stevenson, thank you so much for giving up your lunch hour to be a guest on Read On.
It's a great pleasure.
The past, as we have been told so many times, is a foreign country where things are done differently. This may be true, indeed it patently is true, when it comes to morals or customs, the role of women, aristocratic government, and a million other elements of our daily lives. But there are similarities, too. Ambition, envy, rage, greed, kindness, selflessness, and above all, love, have always been as powerful in motivating choices as they are today. This is a story of people who lived 2 centuries ago, and yet much of what they desired, much of what they resented, and the passions raging in their hearts were only too like the dramas being played out in our own ways, in our own time.
Juliet Stevenson narrating Belgravia by Julian Fellowes, which is TB23163. For a full list of books narrated by Juliet Stevenson, go to the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Talking books are wonderful. They enable people who can't read anymore to join in with the rest of the world and be a part of the world. I think they're excellent. I enjoy biography. I enjoy travel. I enjoy classics. I enjoy a good tale. With some of the readers, there is a problem that you can go to sleep in the middle when you get to my age.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show, usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios, but for the next few weeks, recorded in bedrooms and under stairs. Now, Red, you're not succumbing to cabin fever, are you?
No, I've got a stack of books that I have been pretending that I've read most of my life that I can now work my way through. My daughter is also studying English A-level, so I'm going through some of her books with her and managing to get out for my daily walk. But I'm aware not everybody is so lucky.
Well, if cabin fever is hitting you, our friends Saraband Publishers have the answer.
Saraband Books are an independent publisher in Scotland. During this time of self-isolation and social distancing, cabin fever is real, and they don't want anyone to feel scared or alone, so they started a podcast. A place to share stories, spread calm, and have a laugh. Here's episode 1 of Cabin Fever Fables.
Hello, and welcome to Cabin Fever Fables. I'm Sarah Hunt from indie publisher Saraband, and this is episode 1. Each day, we are challenging an author to read an isolation, sickness, fear, loneliness, or other coronavirus-themed extract from their book. But it has to be fun, or fascinating, or hopeful, or helpful, or all of the above. Tricky challenge. Who better to meet this challenge than the absolutely brilliant Graham McRae Burnett? Graham's second novel, His Bloody Project, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2016, and it's been translated many times, published around the world. I've never thought of the book this way before, but it's about a boy who's pretty isolated and for whom there are limited options when it comes to available foodstuffs. And certainly no toilet paper. This is not the standard blurb for that book. But I digress anyway, because Graham has responded to today's challenge with a different reading. It's a stroke of genius, no surprise there. Graham's third novel, The Accident on the A35, is in part the story of a French detective, Chief Inspector Gorski, who's busy investigating a sudden death with circumstances that appear to indicate an accident, although there may be more to it. We met Gorski in Graham's first novel, The Disappearance of Adèle Badeau. As this investigation is getting underway, Gorski's wife leaves him. He's thrust into enforced isolation at home. How is this sudden change of living circumstances affecting him?
For the first few days after his wife's departure, Gorski had taken advantage of the situation by shaving in the ensuite bathroom. It was an act of defiance. As a rule, he shaved in the cramped WC on the ground floor. Barely a month after they had married and moved into the house on Rue de Village Neuf, he had been banished from the ensuite. He took too long and left a ring of whiskers in the wash basin. The ensuite became Céline's domain, and even in her absence, Gorski felt that he was encroaching on her territory. So he reverted to using the WC downstairs. Then, after a week or so, as if to test the limits of his freedom, he had decided not to shave at all. After all, with Céline gone, he could do whatever he wanted. Over his morning coffee that same day, he had smoked a cigarette in the kitchen. He could not bring himself to leave the butt in the ashtray, however. What if this turned out to be the day that Céline chose to return? All that day, Gorski had felt self-conscious in his unshaven state, but no one at the station commented on his unkempt appearance. In the afternoon, he called on an elderly widow in Rue Saint-Jean who claimed some tools had been stolen from her garden. When she opened the door, she peered at him suspiciously. A lapdog yapped at her feet. Gorski ran his hand over the stubble on his chin. He felt slovenly and unprofessional. The tools, it turned out, were in the garden shed. "Oh, yes," the woman had said. "I remember putting them in there now." But she had not apologised for wasting Gorski's time.
Thanks, Graham. I really love that book, and it's good to hear a bit of rebellion going on. Now, I'm going to ask you four questions, and we'll be asking all our authors these same questions. You may have noticed we're not actually in the same room for this conversation. It's evening now and Graham has been relaxing with a glass of wine. Will he sound different? Let's see. Question one. You're in isolation. You're at home. What are you reading to pass the time?
The book I'm reading to pass the time at the moment is a book called Block Life, Stories from the Lost World of Communism. By Peter Molloy. This is a book of reminiscences or interviews with people who lived under communism in East Germany, Czechoslovakia and Romania. Some of them were people who were true believers in the communist state. Others were dissidents. But there's a kind of... I'm fascinated by the idea of living under totalitarianism. And weirdly, reading this book at the time of the onset of the coronavirus and self-isolation feels kind of prescient that, you know, we're isolating ourselves at home and we feel that our freedoms are being curtailed. So it's kind of a coincidence that I'm reading this book at the moment, but it's very readable and I'm enjoying it tremendously. Block Life by Peter Molloy.
Question two. What are you cooking tonight? I'm assuming that's probably something from your store cupboard.
Tonight, I am on my third night because I'm currently living alone of eating some roast chicken that I made 2 days ago. I'm a great believer in mass cooking and then reinventing it on each subsequent night. And with chicken, you can always reinvent chicken. So tonight we're going a bit Chinesey, a bit of five spice, bit of chili, bit of soy sauce, a little bit of rice, always frozen peas. I've been having trouble getting frozen peas, but I got some today. Very, very happy. I can't live without frozen peas. So we're going sort of reinvented roast chicken, Chinese style. Not very authentic, but it will be tasty.
Question 3. Who would you choose to dine with tonight if we were not all self-isolating? It can be anyone. They don't have to be practical or nearby or people you know how to contact. Just pick your ideal companions.
Who would I like to dine with? That is always such a difficult question. I have a yen to dine with Isabel Huppert. I'd love to cook for her. I think she'd be really fussy though, and she would look at me in that disdainful French actress way and say, "I can't believe you're serving me this Chinese chicken. It's so not authentic." But I think what I would do would be a little ply her with a lot of wine, and then we'd forget about the inauthenticity of the cooking, and we'd actually have a really good chat. I think maybe as well, if I can have some other guests, I think I'd have Nick Cave here. Nick Cave is so skinny, he clearly doesn't eat anything, so he wouldn't be concerned about the quality of the food. Me, Nick Cave and Isabel Huppert. I think that sounds like a little party at a socially acceptable distance.
Question 4. What's the most idiotic or funny or noteworthy bit of corona advice or official tip or corona behaviour that you've seen today?
Idiotic coronavirus advice. I'm not sure. Nobody knows what's happening. And I was in the Mitchell Library today, and since I've come home, I've had 2 emails from staff at the Mitchell Library saying that the Mitchell Library is now closed. So I am now, you know, officially isolating myself as a writer in my house. I think, you know, we've all got to do what we need to do. Today I saw, you know, there was a guy who was in, when I was in the Mitchell Library, there was a guy with a baby in a pram, and he apologetically didn't want to get in the lift with somebody else. But the other guy said, "No, no, you get in the lift, I'll take the stairs." It was just a nice little moment of people being considerate to each other and people being considerate towards each other's concerns. And I think there's quite a lot of that sort of spirit around at the moment, and long may it continue. So no idiocy, just being nice. I think we all need to do that.
Being nice. What a great way to end episode 1 of Cabin Fever Fables. Thanks, Graham. Please do check out his books. Buy them from a bookshop. They need your support as much as the authors do, and we indie publishers too. We'll be linking to shops that do deliveries, or shops and websites where you can order books. You could always go to hive.co.uk and find out how to help a bookshop and get free delivery. Contact us and we'll help if we can. Maybe we'll even sell you a book. We're on Twitter, at Saraband Books. I'm Sarah Hunt from Saraband. Please tune in soon for episode 2 of Cabin Fever Fables.
Thanks so much to Sarah and Graham. Saraband Books are on at Saraband Books on Twitter, and their web address is saraband.net. SARABAND.net. And of course, Graham's books are available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Just head to Reading Services, that's all one word, readingservices.rnib.org.uk, and search for Graham McRae Burnett. RNIB Library is free to join for anyone with a print disability. You can sign up while you're at readingservices.rnib.org.uk, or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And finally, on today's show.
As the author of books such as The Lie Tree and Cuckoo Song, Frances Harding has become one of the best-selling and best-loved authors of young adult fiction in the UK. So who better to ask for some fantastic book recommendations? Here's Frances Harding with the books of her life. Frances, was there a book that you read as a young person that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, actually, there were quite a lot of those. I mean, I read voraciously when I was young, but for a long time, one of my favourites was Watership Down. It was certainly my favourite book when I was 10, and looking back, it was my first epic saga. And I think a lot of parents who see this bunny on the cover probably don't realise that it's actually a harrowing tale of adventure with two dystopias, the massacre of an entire community, punitive mutilation, a war, escapes, a dictator who just happens to be a bunny. It's quite strong stuff, but very good.
He ran down the field and over the brook to the cattle wade. Here there was a delay, for Fiver, surrounded on all sides by the quiet summer evening, became helpless and almost paralysed with fear. When, at last, Hazel got him back to the ditch, he refused at first to go underground, and Hazel had almost to push him down the hole. The sun set behind the opposite slope. The wind turned colder with a scatter of rain, and in less than an hour it was dark. All colour had faded from the sky, and though the big board by the gate creaked slightly in the night wind, as though to insist it had not disappeared in the darkness but was still firmly where it had been put, there was no passer-by to read the sharp, hard letters that cut straight as black knives across his white surface. They said, "This ideally situated estate, comprising 6 acres of excellent building land, is to be developed with high-class modern residences by Such and Martin Limited of Newbury, Berkshire."
Watership Down by Richard Adams is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB2576, which is narrated by Robin Holmes. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, there's one that I've always loved, which I also encountered when I was quite young. I think I was about 16. And that's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Because it's just funny. And when I first encountered it, I sort of felt like it was giving me permission for my slightly weird sense of humour. So I always feel a happy sense of connection with it.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a wholly remarkable book. It has been compiled and recompiled many times over many years and under many different editorships. It contains contributions from countless numbers of travellers and researchers. The introduction begins like this. "Space," it says, "is big. Really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen." And so on.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB5072, narrated by Gordon DeLieu. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, fairly recently, I ended up reading The Master and Margarita. I'd been meaning to for ages. It's by Bulgakov, and it was written in a way as a comment on the oppressive nature of Stalin's regime, but it doesn't read that way at all. It's actually very funny and a sort of dark fairy tale where Satan and his minions turn up in Moscow and start causing mayhem left, right and centre. And it has a large cigar-smoking cat who is variably sarcastic at people. And it's weird and macabre and funny and anarchic and very readable.
At the sunset hour of one warm spring day, two men were to be seen at Patriarch's Ponds. The first of them, aged about 40, dressed in a greyish summer suit, was short, dark-haired, well-fed, and bald. He carried his decorous pork-pie hat by the brim, and his neatly shaven face was embellished by black horn-rimmed spectacles of preternatural dimensions. The other, a broad-shouldered young man with curly reddish hair and a check cap, pushed back to the nape of his neck, was wearing a tartan shirt, chewed white trousers, and black sneakers. The first was none other than Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz, editor of a highbrow literary magazine and chairman of the management committee of one of the biggest Moscow literary clubs, known by its abbreviation as Masolit.
Steve Hodson's masterful reading of The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, which is TB1812. Francis Harding, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
And don't forget, we're always available as a podcast. Just search for Read On, the audiobook show, in your favourite provider to subscribe, rate, or leave a review.
5 stars, please. We're also available on Twitter. I'm @talking_books, and Red is
@RedSale, which is REDSZELL.
So stay safe, stay home.
And we'll be back with some more great books next week. Bye for now.